Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to What Women Want with Amy Annette.
Thank you so much for listening. How exciting that you're here. If you've listened to the show before, you'll know this is a comedy conversation show. Who thought of that? But it is where we talk about the misconceptions, misunderstandings, and misogyny involved in being a woman. I'm so pleased to be sharing this conversation that I had with Emily Gordon and Monica Heise talking about writing back in the past, aka 2020. Now, I could pretend that I'm releasing this because Monica's new Sky show, Smothered, great name, comes out on the 7th of December in the year of our Lord, the singer, of course, 2023, aka next week. But that would be a bold-faced lie that painted me out to be some sort of PR genius. But I will delight in the neatness of it all. This is the recording where I can hear how delighted I am to be with these people. At one point, I think I just said, "This is so nice," in such a sincere way, and truly at such a bizarre time. So I just had to take it out. But please know, it's in there, emotionally. I had also at that time, quote-unquote, discovered skincare. So we do touch on that too, like two older sisters indulging me. We can have it all. So please, join me as we listen to Pass Me talk with Emily Gordon and Monica Heise about what women want is to write.
Thank you so much. So the show is called What Women Want, and the idea is that we share personal experiences and things we've learned about being a woman, and also just dissect what it means. The whole idea for me is that feminism is a critical way of looking at the world. So looking at like the everyday things we do through a feminist lens. Mostly it's just people being like, "I'm tired.
Why does this keep happening to me?
I'm so tired." Yeah. And so I thought it'd be interesting to talk to two writers and think about what that means. But also if we just end up talking about, you know, our skincare routines, that's also fine. Have you heard of Kiehl's, guys?
Do you know Vintner's Daughter?
No.
That's the one. It's an oil I put on my face. It smells like a garden.
Yeah. You have great skin as well.
I do appreciate that. Wasn't fishing, but Vintner's Daughter will change your life.
Yes.
Highly expensive. Change your life.
Yes. I do think it. My two faves are super expensive, but enough people say it's worth it, or incredibly cheap. And it's like, it actually is just as good as the expensive thing.
I have a couple serums that I sort of like are my like party serums, and I never feel guilty about how much I'm using because they were so cheap. And
yeah.
I just like goo my whole face.
Good.
Down.
Yeah. I feel like, especially when it comes to skincare, it's like the new way to make women talk about beauty and make them think that they've like, it's scientific in some way, which makes it okay. Like I'm impressed by the way that capitalism is adapting to feminism.
Sure.
To make us.
Consumerism as self-care. Absolutely. Yeah. I love it.
Me too. I even love it ironically. And then that just translates to just pure enjoyment.
Well, this is the thing. Okay, this is going to sound like a brag, but it's just true. I interviewed Gloria Steinem once.
Whoa.
And she asked her about like a jeans advert that I saw that was, it was like, like a multicultural feminist fantasy, and it was a video about empowering women, and then at the end it was like jeans. And Gloria Steinem was like, "Well, when they've started pandering to you, you're probably winning." I don't know if I think that that's true.
But I feel like, I think you're right. I don't know. Are we recording?
Yeah.
I don't know. They pander to you, but also, like, you can only then feel good if you spend that money. Because I agree with that. But then I'm like, I'm only worthy then if I spend money. Mm. It only is good for me if I'm able to spend the money on it.
Yeah, and I don't know that the jeans like knowing that what women want to see is an empowering video, I don't think they're actually making women empowered in any real way in their lives. Like, you probably still have to buy the plus size version of those jeans online only.
And they might cost more money.
Yeah.
Because that's
because of your big yeah. legs.
Yeah. It takes more fabric. Yeah. Just think about it.
But that's interesting. Maybe two things I think about that. And it's like, one thing is you have to enjoy it with an element of like feminist critique. That feels worthy, but maybe a bit exhausting. And we probably should engage with every piece of advertising with a certain amount of skepticism. Mm. But and obviously that's why like social media advertising is so pernicious, because you're just like in your bed,
you're in at night,
yeah, not and thinking about things.
You're opting into it. Like, I follow a bunch of homeware stores accounts.
Why do I do that?
Why do I do that?
Yeah, they're not giving me anything.
And now I want a fringe lamp more than I've wanted anything yes, in my life.
Me too. So that's interesting. Aesthetic. Whenever I, because you did a great article recently, Monica, segueing to the topic of the day, your article about headbands and being targeted specifically to buy a thing
targeted.
So hugely pointless. Like, you yeah. can't even, like, with at least, like, with skincare, there's some, like, apparent element of, like, yeah. health that you're looking after. And yet, you know, you were talking about how you bought two headbands, and here we
three.
Are.
Three. Three padded, like, trendy padded headbands.
Yeah, those are really cute these days. Yeah.
They're so cool. But I have a fringe, so I can't even really do it. Like, I'm not at a place right now where I can show my forehead to the public. That's just my limitation, and I'm living within it. So why do I own those? That's the object exists to push your hair out of your face, and I'm not comfortable doing that, so they're just in my house.
Mm. It's been interesting being here, because I left most of my life in Los Angeles and came here, and I kept being like, I guess I don't need as much as I thought I did. Mm. Because all of the shit that I consider to be very important, material things, is all in another country, and I don't miss it even a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's been kind of messing with me lately. Like, because I grew out my bangs last year, have a slew of headbands.
Sure.
Great. Slew. from that period where I was like trying to figure it out. And I'm like, yeah, I got to keep those because I might want to wear those again.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm going to wear those again. But also, then I'm just creating waste if I throw them out.
Yes.
Yeah, can't win.
But also throwing them out would be some sort of like, I don't know, rejection of some sort of beauty ideal that you might come back to.
Maybe
know.
I'll come back. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A version of myself that it looks good in it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That it will never exist. And I'm like, oh, one day.
One day.
I'm going to get there.
100% yeah. live in protection of and anticipation of a version of myself that has never existed.
It'll be just right.
But I work much harder for that version of myself than I do for like the actual version of myself now. Like, I think I'm. And because I'm doing the easy things, like, I'm going to stop talking about skincare. can you find out? I just found out about skincare, guys. Wow, Glossier. I don't want to talk about it. Would love to be supported by them financially, but
that, I feel like buying that stuff is the, like, consumer equivalent of taking a picture of a celebrity to the hair salon and expecting to look like the celebrity when you get the haircut.
Yeah.
And they're like, honey, that's a wig.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I've actually done that exact thing and had that exact thing said to me.
I love that they said it's a wig though, rather than what they has always happened to me. And they go, okay. And then they just like cut some bangs and like maybe some layers around my chin.
Yeah.
Because what they're trying to do,
you gotta frame
that face.
Can't be on its own.
So this is what women want. Thank you so much for joining me, Monica Heisey and Emily Gordon. I'm going to do my radio voice because I'm a serious woman. Today we're looking at what women want is to write. I would love to hear from you both off the top of your head. What does it mean to you to think about writing within a feminist lens? And then we're just going to chat and then that will be it.
Cool.
This is a medium called podcast, and it's pretty cool. I think you'd like it. We just chat, and we laugh, and people listen.
Yeah, I know a few men who have those.
Yeah.
So it's like friendship.
It's like friendship.
That you have to subscribe to.
You have to subscribe to, and it's semi-performative.
Okay. That's great.
Now you know where we are. So what I was thinking about when I thought about feminist writing in a feminist way was just, my overall thought was just like, surely that's one of the more clear-cut feminist things in this world. Creating on your own terms. Have I read the essay? No. Do I know it exists? A Room of One's Own? Yes. I knew that what Wolf was talking about was the need for a physical space to write, but also a space within literary fiction to be considered a writer. But the practical aspect of it has always been really interesting to me, like the practical aspects of creating. So many male writers have a very forgiving wife, and how, you know, the woman is a muse or she's a caregiver, but she's very rarely the creator. So it does feel like an inherently feminist thing. But then also, as someone who works in an industry with writers and writes herself, I'm also aware that as a woman in an industry that is still quite male dominated, you're bumping up against very unequivocal sort of sexism and racism, not daily, but not less than yearly. And so trying to have this thing where you're doing this absolutely punk rock feminist thing, making money from writing, being a creator, but also every day trying to figure out what it means to be a female writer. I'd love to know from you how you manage that. And also what it means to you to be a writer outside of being a female writer or a writer who may write female characters, the joy of writing and what it means for you to write female characters and also maybe to see the world in a different way because you do write. These are all the things I was thinking about. Emily, when you saw that I'd asked you about your job, a thing that you should probably ask about 1,000 times, what did you think?
I do think I come from a very practical family, like Southern family. So writing was not ever considered a career that one could have. My family, and I think it is very much from the women in my family. This is not every woman, but it's not every Southern woman, but definitely my family. It's your job is to stay out of the way as much as possible. Like a life well lived is a life where you kind of keep your head down, stay out of the way, don't make any waves. Everything's cool. Just be easy. And I was a therapist before this, and that was a lovely kind of career that gave me way more about tips for writing than any level of being a woman ever has. Although, sure, mutually exclusive. But I think now, as a writer, it is my job to make a fuss. Mm. And I don't mean that like in a literal, I'm fucking disrupting. I mean that and I literally have to make a fuss of, no, I think it should be this way. And I see the character this way. This is why I'm thinking of that. And I think it's taken me a bit to realize I get to be an expert in that too. Because I think for a while, because I came into screenwriting not having gone to school for it, I was like, oh, these other people are experts. I'm going to let them tell me what to do. I'm going to let them kind of help me. And it's only been in the last couple of years that I've realized, oh, these are not my teachers. These aren't my bosses. These are my coworkers. That's been a really big thing for me to advocate for myself and for the characters I'm writing and for how I see a scene and realizing that these people don't know anything that they're doing any more than I do. Mm. Nobody has any idea what they're doing. So I think that's been kind of a freeing thing for me is realizing that is my job similar to how I did as a therapist, where I had to stick up for my clients, I have to stick up for my own vision of things. I have to realize that my vision is an important way of doing things. Doesn't mean I don't take notes. Doesn't mean I don't listen to other people's ideas. Mm. On occasion, they're okay. but I do have to, like, I get to stick up for that. And I have to stick up for that.
It's very interesting. I love the idea of coming to an idea of realizing that you can't do your job unless you do something that might be considered unlikable. I feel like one of the ways I get my friends to have worth, like have self-worth or even think about having self-worth, my friends are fine. I should just say that now. I can never be like, you deserve it. I have to be like, you have to have it to do a good job. It's very hard to make people understand that they should have self-worth just because they deserve it unequivocally. You have to understand it sometimes through, that's the only way I'm going to be able to do this.
Yeah.
And then you maybe come to a stage where you're like, also, I clearly deserve it.
Yeah. The deserving, but that's not, to me, that isn't the part of it that is, the deserving part of it isn't the thing I should advocate for. Because in my head, and again, I think this might be Southern more than anything, no, you don't deserve anything. Mm. Nobody does. Who do you think you are? You're getting too big for your britches. So it's more of what's the best thing to get this job done and do a good job. I also do the thing if I'm going to be difficult in a meeting, if I've gotten 5 sets of notes from somehow 3 people, and you're like, how did I get 5 sets? I always preface it by going, and guess what? I'm about to be the difficult woman.
Yes.
And I kind of make a joke out of it because then I'm like, we all know this is ridiculous. No one gets to call me difficult for doing this. Yeah. I get to do whatever I want.
Yeah.
And now you're going to listen to me say this. And I find that making that joke helps. Is that selling myself out? I don't know. Let me know. Yeah. Call in. What's the number? 1-800?
My mobile number is. Yeah. that's great, Emily. Thank you. Monica, when you were thinking about your career and how you write or just writing in general, and what it might mean to be a feminist version of that. What did you think?
Yeah, it's one of the questions that you asked was in the very thorough little email that you sent.
Thank you.
Beforehand was, do you ever get to be just a writer? And it was interesting just now hearing you say, you know, that it's inherently feminist to create on your own terms, because really so much of being a professional writer, and especially I think a professional female writer, and especially in the early stages of my career, it wasn't really on my own terms. I was writing the things that I was assigned, and the things that I was assigned tended to be really gendered. I mean, lots of people have written and talked about how, especially when I was working in media, the kinds of stories that women, young women at the start of their careers are assigned or get commissioned when they pitch them are, you know, I wrote like 7 sexting guides. Like whenever my rent was due, I would pitch a sexting guide because I knew they would take it. Or if I wanted to write like a humiliating dating story, you know, it was like they were these really, really gendered female coded stories. And I've always felt a bit conflicted about it because I never really wanted to do serious writing. I always wanted to joke around, and I found that by being a little self-deprecating or going into territories like sex or relationships, I could write the funny stuff that I was hoping to write for or write about, instead of having to do like serious journalism. But then I have complicated feelings about that too, because I don't think that those are lesser areas. I just think it's bizarre that those are the only areas that we kind of let young women cut their teeth. And I feel like someone I think about all the time is David Sedaris, because he's a domestic essayist. He writes essays about rebuilding his lake house and fights with his boyfriend and what his sisters are like. And no one would ever put a high-heeled shoe on the cover of his fucking book. And like when I wrote my essay collection, I had to fight them to not include the word grown ass woman on the cover.
Wow.
And it's pink. And
mine's pink too. Yeah. I did not want that.
Yeah. They showed me a proof that was red, and then they printed it pink. I was like, and you know what? And then again, complicated feelings, because I was like, it just can't be pink. Mm. And I don't know why.
Right?
Do you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing wrong with a pink book. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with writing about relationships or writing about the domestic sphere. I think it's just frustrating that you can only have a pink book and you can only sell it as this, like, little girl wrote a book. And David Sedaris gets a fucking skull smoking a cigarette.
Yeah.
Like a Lucian Freud painting or something, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so cool. But then the essays inside, if you just changed his gender, the whole thing would be different. And he gets to just be a wit and an observer of modern life and modern relationship mores. And women writers are always like neurotic women, and they always talk about, like, you know, like she's an observer of the minute, tiny little moments of the everyday, these insignificant little moments she makes significant. And it's like, maybe they're just significant. This is why I cried so much watching Little Women.
Yes. So many people, when they hear about writing, just think it's such a foreign, impossible thing for them to do, which is interesting because it's something that most people do a version of every day.
Yeah.
But there's something about professionally writing, creating, owning it, like creating a new narrative that didn't exist before, that feels so empowering and, I don't know, so unique to whoever the person is creating. But in fact, as with most things, the actuality of it, which is probably what Wolf was talking about, because what she was interested in was like a desk, like give me a door with a lock.
Yeah.
You know, like the actual day to day of anything is always going to be impeded or frustrated by the realities of the person doing it. I read a thing about how women have to have an ego to do everything, even if it would be useful for them to be able to come in with a bit of humility and say, like, I'd love to learn some more of this. I'd love to know some details. But in fact, you have to come in with 110% confidence or you won't be let into the room. Is that something that you found as writers?
I think you do have to have confidence, but I also think I think I was misunderstanding what an ego was. And to me, I always thought an ego was like, I know exactly what I'm doing. I'm the fucking best. I'm going to get in there. I think I thought ego was this like internal, I've got this. I know exactly what I'm doing. Mm. Ego can come from the outside in. You can be like, absolutely, I know what I'm doing. I got this. And talk. And it turns out people will listen to you and you probably know what you are talking about, but it doesn't have to start on the inside. Mm. I think that's what I was misunderstanding for myself, at least for a while. Like the call can come from outside the house. It doesn't have to be this like internal, unshakable, I know what I'm doing. Because it turns out nobody knows what they're doing, especially when it comes to screenwriting. Everybody's just making stuff up all the time.
I mean, professionally making stuff up. That's the other thing.
Constantly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, that's what I've learned from collaborating with a lot of men is that whereas we think, oh, I'm going to wait until I have something good to say and then I'll – or I have a good idea and then I'll talk. Men are just talking. they're not – and again, this is all simplifications and all like boiling stuff down. But that's what I've observed being in rooms with men and women in LA specifically. And so I've learned to just start talking. And it turns out you look just as confident from the outside. And that's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you, it feels weird that just a sort of basic, just I'm just going to talk when it feels like an appropriate time for me to talk.
Just talk. Just saying the damn words. Just saying something.
Is equated. That feels like super confidence.
Yes, it does.
Well, yeah. I feel like there must be an insane confidence that comes from like acceptance of your own perspective as universal, right? There's this sense of the white masculine story as like the universal perspective. I hadn't even realized, like, I feel like I saw Little Women too recently. It's too raw. But I hadn't even realized watching it, and I had the same exact experience watching Lady Bird. I just cried like the entire time throughout. And I hadn't really realized, because there's lots of white women in movies, and I hadn't really realized how that specific perspective that I related to so much, I hadn't really seen before I saw Lady Bird and Little Women. And there are definitely movies that have presented that I've missed out on, like, I don't know, Ghost World or something.
Love Ghost World.
But I know it's like a classic moody white woman film that I haven't seen, and I really should.
And of course, Thora would play me in a movie.
Of course.
100%. Yeah. 1,000%.
Yeah, I don't know where she is now, so I hope she's available.
She has quit acting, but we can get her back.
Yes, I'm going to.
We can get her back. Thank you.
But I feel like, you know, if you're questioning whether your perspective is worthwhile, and obviously the more marginalized identities you have overlapping over each other, the more you are forced to ask yourself this question and the harder it becomes to fight against it and have the confidence. It lets you butt in the conversation or not even think of it as butting in. Just think about it as contributing, for God's sake.
For God's sake.
Yeah, I'm just enjoying using the word butt in as if it's like some sort of like scientific. Virginia Woolf said, of course, you must butt in the room of your own.
I think that was Sheryl Sandberg. That was her book.
That's true. Yeah, that's her like sequel to Lean In. Butt in. we have women have, or any marginalized person whose story is not told or whose experience is not the sort of norm, has a thought process, has that millisecond of thought process before they speak, before they do anything. And in that sort of moment of doubt or confusion or hesitation, however subconscious it is, that's where it lies.
That's where it creeps in. Yeah.
That's why I feel like people, white men in particular, but white women as well. Anyone with privilege has a hard time, I think, identifying it, because you just sit in privilege like it's a warm bath. You don't notice that you're in it, I think, a lot of the time. Like, I had a colleague on a sketch show that I worked on, and this was his first gig on the show. And I'd been working in TV comedy for years. And 2 weeks into the room, maybe the first week, he like stopped me on the way out and was like, "Just so you know, you're doing great."
Oh, God.
And I was like, "Thanks, man. You too." But I think he genuinely thought he was doing a nice thing.
Yeah.
You know? And I felt totally disrespected in that moment. Like, my years of experience meant nothing to this much younger man who was much less experienced. But I don't think he would, A, remember that moment, or B, understand it, even if I brought it up. And I think he'd be mortified to know that I hated that.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of him being mortified.
Yeah, true.
It's fun to think about. I'm thinking about it right now. It feels great.
Maybe I'll call him.
We kept talking about, when it comes to like especially romantic comedies, which I am not a fan of, despite the fact that I've written one. I appreciate you saying that. I hope that part of why I hate them. I mostly hate them. And I was thinking about how everything I know about how to be a desirable, cool, like interesting woman comes from that media that I've consumed, comes from what desirable, cool women do, how they're supposed to act. And all of that, pretty much all of them have been written by men. And so it's impossible to even, we kept talking about this while we were writing The Big Sick, because we kept talking about like, what does it mean to mean that like, what does it mean to have it be an actual female point of view on a romantic comedy? Because my brain is addled with all of the things that I've learned from other romantic comedies of like, I need to be like approachable and cool, but I need to have one flaw, but only the one flaw, and it can only come up at the right time. And all this stuff. We had a conversation. There's a part in our movie that Emily, the character Emily, who is not me, but is me, after she has sex with the character Kumail, is trying to get dressed after they have sex, and she's trying to like hide herself while she's getting dressed. And I got into an argument with several men. I will not name their names. All wonderful men. I had great partners who were like, I don't believe that a woman who looks like that would want to hide herself while getting dressed. And then it led to this like, and why do you think that? Because you've only seen women do the very elaborate thing of getting dressed and like putting on the guy's shirt and one boob is hanging out. You've only seen that in movies that are written by men who want to see naked women, because naked women look hot. That's not what this is. This is like a different kind of thing. And my version of this is, I don't care if we were just raw dogging, I'm going to get dressed a little shy. I'm going to get dressed a little shy because it's not the same thing. And the very, very basic idea that everything we've learned about how post-coitus looks in a movie comes from movies that were written by men. For the most part, women have written amazing ones too. And men have written amazing ones. And really, really well-observed women are in rom-coms like written by men. But it is just this thing of like me having to go through and untangle, what have I learned from these movies? What have I gotten from this media? And who was it aimed for? It never has been aimed to me.
This is why I didn't know that you have to pee after sex. Exactly. This is why I got a kidney infection in university.
But that's not a thing that men know about.
No. Only knowing that as well was a thing that I got really obsessed with. It was like someone had told me that and I was like, cool. Like, that's the one.
I'm going to spread this around. Pee.
Yeah, it's like, I got to pee. But I would run out of the room. I'd be like, it's pee time. I got to pee right now. And if I couldn't pee, I'd be like, oh, I guess I die this way.
Well, you might. She had to go to it.
I had to go to the hospital. Yes. And then I went home on like during like homecoming weekend because I had this horrible kidney infection. But I still, no one told me that the hospital that it was a sex related thing either.
Yeah.
But my family knew because I had just gotten my first boyfriend in first year university. We were having sex like 12 times a day. And I came home like with a kidney infection. They were like, yeah, you did. Yeah, you did. Okay.
So you didn't even know enough to call it something else.
No. I'm just proudly telling everyone I was doing it.
I don't know what happened. Maybe I wasn't drinking enough water. Oh, really? You think that was it?
But that's I remember watching some really classic American sitcom that was brought to the UK about 10 years after it aired in America. It was on a cable channel that doesn't exist anymore called Trouble. I miss it every day. Of course, we had Hang Time. Of course, we had American High, an American high school show that did not exist outside of Europe, for sure. Because everyone was like kind of American, but they all played basketball in a really weird way.
And I bet their shoes were way too nice.
I remember watching these shows and learning that you wipe back to front. Because one of the mothers was like, weirdly shouted to her child as she ran from the room, wipe back to front, which was like a throwaway joke. And I was like,
okay, nobody? I'm obsessed told me that. With the concept wipe back to front, because every time,
sorry, front to back,
right. Yes, yeah, I was like,
I'm so sorry,
I don't want to impugn,
that's how you get really bad things happening to you.
I don't want to impugn this TV show 100% front to back.
Yeah. Wait, did you not know before?
To pee, not the other way around. I don't remember being really told
about it. Yeah,
I don't think I did it wrong. Knew not to do it.
Yeah, I don't think I was
way.
Doing it wrong necessarily. I don't think I was conscious of how I was doing it. It was more that I was like, oh, there's a rule.
Yeah,
I didn't know.
But I'm obsessed with any time that I get like any kind of gynecological problem. If you have to go to the pharmacy, particularly with Thresh, my very close personal friend. Every time, every single time that I go, every pharmacist asks if I'm wiping back to front. And I'm like a 31-year-old woman.
That's so funny.
They have all these questions. Like, I wrote a sketch about this for Baroness von Sketch Show because I just feel like every single time I go to the pharmacy, they're like, do you know how to take care of your own vagina? Do
I'm
you?
Loving also, imagining your face as they say that to you.
Some people are not taught anything. People's parents are like terrified to discuss it.
Fair enough.
However, I also picture them having like a sad little checklist that for every prescription of a certain type, they're like, did you ask the question?
Yeah.
Is she wiping back to front?
But Yeah. Wow. But also imagine, like, we live in a world where it's like there's certain things that just like are not culturally talked about. Like, yeah. I can't imagine that you're a young man who doesn't know much about wanking that doesn't come from TV.
That's right.
We all remember American Pie, you know, the feature film dedicated to wanking that I loved as a kid.
A lot of boys fuck pies.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Yeah.
I think a lot of boys have fucked food.
Even though the point of that film was
don't do that.
Yeah.
I think it's part of the writer's job to give little nuggets of information like that. Anytime I hear something like that in a script, in a movie, I'm always like, oh, someone had a weird experience like, I'm going to put this in something so that I can teach the children. Because
Shrill did that.
Yeah.
With the Plan B pill doesn't work if you're over like
170
pounds,
that's
I think.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That is information people need to know.
Yeah, I could have used that several years ago.
but also even things like, with the way that people do stand-up now, people often say stand-up has become something. There's lots of conversations around, does stand-up need to be so worthy? Like, has stand-up become too informative, educational? Like, obviously, in part, people are just reacting to the madness of the world and they're trying to make sense of it. So they'll read articles or they'll talk to their learned friends and then they'll relay that information. But I think, especially when I hear other women doing stand-up, like, it's often not them being like, did you know that in 1991, blah, 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 very much and my style of comedy. But it's more just when they, like, share a cool, like, a sort of tip or a trick that they've learned, like, how to deal with catcallers or something.
Yeah.
You know, it is part of their everyday life. It is an observation. It is funny. But it's also just, like, very tangible information. For example, my version of that is, did you know you can change your YouTube settings really easily? So the ad that comes up on your YouTube, if you just right click it, there's like a little thing you can say depersonalized.
Oh.
So it will no longer give you like very targeted, frankly, pregnancy test ads. Mm. It will instead give you just like will writing ads.
I changed my age on Facebook for this.
Yes.
'Cause I was getting a lot of ads for like wedding harpists.
That's amazing.
And stuff.
Wow.
I respect that.
What did you change your age to?
Like 88 years old. And now it's now? Like retirement stuff, like vacation communities.
Nice.
Yeah, it's very gentle.
Cruises.
Mm. It's a good way to fuck the system.
Yeah.
Without really having to do
very much. Very much again, my style of feminism. But we're still talking about representation in a roundabout way and talking about how we write our life experiences into our writing, but also how empowering it can feel. Like with Shrill, for example, I didn't expect to be as affected as I was by seeing someone like Adi Bryant just living her life. It's explicitly about being fat. So it's not just like, I'm happy and nothing in my life is bad because I'm confident and I'm respectful to my elders. You know, it's not fitting in as a way of thriving. It's like I'm surviving by tackling the thing that you think should ruin me is actually just part of my life. I didn't expect to be as affected by it as I was. And one thing as well about the Virginia Woolf quote, I think it was Alice Walker who did a critique of it, being like, you wanted a room of your own, but lots of like women of color, especially black women in America, wanted like to own their own body.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the limitation of some of our feminist critique is often about like, I finally see myself in this like highly educated white lady who, you know, is like learning to love herself. Whereas in fact, often what feminism, where it fails, is when it becomes white feminism, where it only tackles like very privileged things. Do you find that when you're writing, do you feel more of a pressure as a intelligent feminist woman to tackle big issues and sort of bring to light inequality? Is that something that is a good thing that drives you? Does it drive you at all? Is that part of your process?
I think if you set, for me personally, if I set out to deliver a message to the world, I feel like people can smell that coming a mile away, especially if you're in the entertainment business. People can smell that a mile away and they don't like it. Yeah. They don't want to eat that shit. People don't like medicine. They don't want to be told to take their medicine. I think it's more revolutionary the way that Shrill did to kind of portray people existing without putting the pressure of, and also you have to be this and you have to be this and you have to be this. And doing that as authentically as possible is kind of the best way to do it. I'm a producer on a show that's coming out soon on Apple called Little America. That's just stories of immigrants that come to the U.S. and they're all stories that are based on reality. And then we've kind of dramatized them. And each story has its own writer and director that is, for the most part, as much as we could, from the same area that the immigrant came from. And we had to fight a little bit, and I'm not all over the place, everybody, we had to fight a bit to be like, we got to really show that the hardships of coming. Mm. But that's, I don't want to see misery porn. Nobody, I'm tired of seeing stories of, I'm tired of seeing stories of people who are marginalized getting beaten down, and that's how I get to learn my lesson about what intersectionality is and what inclusivity is. I want to see stories of people having a good time, having little tiny stories, having things that feel insignificant, perhaps, to other people, little stories. I want to see the big ones, too. I want to see all of them. I just think I'm tired of seeing movies where it's just that are just about slavery over and over again, that are just rooted in the pain. That I want to see movies that are rooted in more than just the pain of people who are marginalized. So I think, I think that's really important, that like if you put the politics of like, and they've been through a lot of shit, absolutely true. But if you put it on that, then I feel like it's still, that's all, the only sense of representation is like suffering.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that bums me out.
And that's the same as like, you know, when I was starting my writing career and only really being told like, but have you been sexually assaulted? Can we get something in that sort of area? It is still like, if you're only letting people tell the stories of the worst things that have ever happened to them, you're not granting them their reality, which is that they have a full life that has joy in it and embarrassment and shame and pain and you know, close family ties or not, you know, and that everyone's got a different combination of all of those things.
And you might find yourself in those emotions with someone that is nothing like you.
Yeah.
That on the outset is nothing like you.
I think the more like specific you can get, the more universal the story ends up being. And so to just do like, you know, a very special episode is much less effective at actually building like an equal or contributing to, because this is not the thing that's going to do it in the end, but it's helping or could help, is just showing that everyone does have these similar core experiences.
Yeah.
Whether they look differently or not.
And clearly we do, because everyone can see has learned to see themselves in people who don't look like them. You know, we do it the other way.
Constantly.
Thinkingly. So why can't it happen the other way?
Mm-hmm.
With Baroness von Sketchow, which you were talking about, a show that you write on that I adore. Have you seen?
I have not.
Oh, Emily, you will love.
Okay.
I won't say
it's Canadian. It's hard to get a hold of.
There are clips on YouTube, and our old friend, the dark web, will help you. That's what I call VPNs. Is that right?
I try to stay away from the dark web.
Oh, no, you've got to get the best comedy is on the dark web.
Buy yourself a kidney and then check out a couple clips of a feminist sketch show.
Baroness One Sketch Show. It's fantastic. Well, I'll let you talk about it, Monica, but one of the sketches that like I remember people lost their shit over was specifically like the over 40 section in the gym, which was like the space where you get to be free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
when I wrote that, I was like 24 or something. And when I had them as like age 60. And my coworkers were like all, I think, around or about to turn 40. And they were like, it happens way sooner than that. You just have no concept. Like, it's so soon. And it's been, I've been working on that show now, like pretty much every summer for the last 5 years. And it is crazy how much of the stuff that they, that seemed so distant to me when I was 24, now that I'm 31, it's all kind of happening already. In this way, that's been really lovely. And I felt like I was so lucky for that to be my first job because I'd wanted a mentor so badly. Mm. They taught me so much and they empowered me to figure out what to do myself. And then they also told me about all of the stuff that was going to go down bodily. And it really has. It really, really has.
But it, in a joyful way, the shocked faces of the 21-year-old in the background and everyone says, vagina out, labia on show.
Yeah. Mary Walsh, who's a Canadian comedian and writer, did a speech recently at the Canadian Screen Awards about how she had turned 60. And she said that getting into her older age was like one of the great privileges of her life because she stopped being an object of someone else's desire or trying to be and kind of got to become the subject of her own story instead. Mm. And I think that's something that I'm also kind of striving to remember when I'm slathering my many serums on in the evening.
Something that I wonder, do you think you see the world in a different way, or I want to say clearer, but maybe that's not quite right, because you're looking out for these things or you're ready to write about inconsistencies or, you know, the funny observations of life sort of motivate you? So does that mean though, when you're in the real world, like if you're in the supermarket and someone's doing something patronizing or something confusing, do you have more clarity, do you think, because of your profession?
I'd love to have more clarity.
Yeah, I feel like there's that thing, someone said it, it wasn't me, so this is not an original thought of mine, but someone said somewhere at some point that if you can't explain something simply in a few sentences, you don't understand it. Mm. And I feel like any writing that I would do is probably because I'm trying to convey it simply. I am trying to understand it, but I don't necessarily. It's sometimes, there are things that I've been trying to write about for years that I can't do properly. And it's because I don't, either I lack the experience or the intelligence or the whatever to fully understand it in a way that you can convey it simply. Mm. And if it's not conveyed simply, then the audience doesn't. I saw Phoebe Waller-Bridge talk recently and she said, the only things you can't do with your audience to your audience are bore them or confuse them. Mm. And I feel like if you're confusing them, then it's because you yourself are still confused.
I think that's very true because I think I feel like all of my training as a therapist has really been the bigger thing for me to kind of be helpful for me as a writer and as an observer of the world, because you are taught as a therapist to observe the person you're with and to observe what they're saying, how that's matching up with how they're acting, all of that good stuff. But I think if we would always say as therapists, you can't take your client any further than you're able to go yourself emotionally. Mm. So if you say have an eating disorder and you are working with people with eating disorders, by the way, I've seen that happen. It's horrifying. Mm. You can't really help a person with an eating disorder if you haven't fully kind of gotten processed your own feelings about it. And I think that's true for writing. I think if you're not ready to write about something that's intense, I find that people go through experiences and then they're like, well, I'm just going to write a one-man show about it. And you're like, bitch, you're crying right now. Like, you're not ready for this. And that's okay. My God, don't be, you don't need to be ready for this. Like I think you have to kind of be an observer of yourself as much as you are the world. And I think that my therapy training has been the most useful thing for me as a writer, of just kind of understanding how people act and how people are desperately trying to present themselves one way and versus how they are. And I think that's been really useful to me. I don't think that's an inherently female or male or whatever trait. I just think, but I do think it could serve for people. I think most writers could serve for being to be a little more observant of people around them. I do think, I just feel like I'll be in a writer's room sometimes and like one person in the room is just like fucking going on and on about how cool they are and how, and everybody's annoyed. Everybody's clearly annoyed at them and they don't know it. And I'm like, how can you be this person who's like a sharp observer of the human condition. Mm. And you don't see that you're annoying everyone so yeah. much right now, and we want you to leave. And I just think, in general, like, being able to kind of stop and, like, put yourself out of a situation and observe it, I think is useful for a billion reasons, for the, like, processing of your own stuff. Mm. I think that stuff's really useful. So, I don't know. And you can get it by not getting a degree in therapy. A lot of this is me just being like, yep, that's right, I got a full degree in something and I don't use it. So, trying to justify it as much as I can to myself, my parents, everyone involved. But yeah, I think that's the most useful.
You've both written books. One, I Can't Believe It's Not Better, Monica, and Super You, Release Your Inner Superhero.
Different vibes.
Different vibes, but actually very similar covers, because I've seen them both. Pink. Very similar. But I was wondering, when you were writing your books and when you were writing your screenplays and you were writing in writers' rooms, do you feel like they're different, like, I don't know, are there different agendas? How did you feel like they play out? How do they compare?
Oh, writing a book is a very solitary experience. It's very lonely. I found that to be a very lonely experience. And so that, whereas a writer's room, I'd say 90% of it is just trying to crack up the other people in the room. Mm. It's, and I don't know how it works at other places, but it is, I find it to be highly inefficient for the most part. So I'm like, God, we're all just swinging our dicks around. Like, I get it. Everybody's very funny. Can we get to work? Yeah. How many more YouTube videos do we need to watch before we can get to work? And I love all that shit too. But, it is very much like group therapy, in that you kind of, there is a dynamic of like who is considered funny, who's considered worthy of being heard from, and who's kind of being talked over. And every room is a little different, but I find it very different than writing a book, because that's just you and the editor. At least, I mean, that was my experience.
Yeah, I was so excited when I started working in TV writing rooms, because I'd been working in media and writing the book by myself for like a couple years before that. And then after like a couple, I was really lucky and I got a bunch of work quite quickly, but then felt kind of socially exhausted after, you know, like a 3-month writing room or something. It's like, I had no idea sitting around a table could be so tiring.
Most exhausting thing.
And it feels so ridiculous. Both my sisters are nurses. Mm. You know what I mean? They'll be like on their feet for a 12-hour shift putting people's catheters in and stuff. And they'll come home and be like, oh, I'm so tired. I'll be like, I'm tired too. Oh.
I had to be on all day.
Yeah. The amount of work involved, I mean, I suppose you could call it emotional labor that everyone's doing, is really, or can be really exhausting. But I love having a balance of the two things. Like, I think they inform each other in a really nice way, because then you're excited to sit alone with your thoughts at the end of it. But then after you've been alone with your thoughts too much and none of your clothes are clean and you want to have a reason to brush your hair, it's lovely to sit in a writer's room with your peers and feel like you have a community that's not just people tweeting at you from their houses where they're not brushing their hair. So I think it's lovely to do, like, I think both kinds of writing inform the other, and they're both really, can be really lovely in different ways. And I think having the two different modes helps you appreciate what's nice about it, so that when you are on the 14th YouTube video of the day, you can remember that it's all right.
Yeah. Feature writing, I find, is a nice compromise, because I'm mostly alone. And then I check in with people like every month or so, and like have like a big sit down with a bunch of people every month or so. And I to me, that's like a nice balance of like, I get to like be on my own, and then I have like a community I can check in with. Yeah, because it's exhausting.
Yeah.
So, well, exhausting.
But this is the thing I find about people who are in any sort of gig economy, any sort of freelance situation, is that everyone in an office job is like coming up against exactly the same things. But when you're in an office job, there's so much more like decorum and systems to disguise it. Mm-hmm. When you're freelance, it's harder to do, because you just inevitably, like, it just becomes much more like text, less subtext, when you're like not getting a job for a certain reason. Is there anything that you've had to learn because of the slightly maybe more explicit pushback you get in a freelance capacity that you could share? Like, something that I've really enjoyed doing, and like more traditional, like working in an office pretty much every day, but then also doing some performing, is like, you can practice being heard, you know. Mm-hmm. If you don't get heard the first time, that's okay. Try it again. you know, the dream is to get an amplified mic. Sure. But then you can't have that in every situation. But, you know, even just like learning what it feels like to be heard, yeah, you can then understand what it's like when you're not being listened to.
That's very good advice.
I think that's, yeah, that's a very good point. I think too, like, just kind of realizing like you aren't only going to get one shot at this. Mm. And I know they say you only get one shot at this, but I think that's not necessarily true. And I think at an office job, you can kind of keep your head down and be like, well, I don't want to stick my neck out too much. Yeah. Mm. Stick your neck out. Like, what is the worst that could happen? Mm. You get fired. Okay. That is the worst. That's not great, but probably not going to happen. I think that like, it's okay to take chances. It's okay to kind of stick your neck out. Is a thing it would have been nice for me to take back into the jobs I had before I was a writer, when I was a therapist and I was like trying to advocate for my clients over other people's clients. Like they could have used that.
Mm.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Maybe I have one.
Okay.
Something that I've been, working longer, something that I feel like is really important that people don't always remember to do, for various different reasons, is to remember what it was like when you were starting. Mm. So if you have a team that's of mixed ability or mixed experience levels, you know, there was a point at one point when you were the least experienced person in the room. Mm. And whether or not you got what you needed or hoped for as the least experienced person, you can now, as a more experienced person, you can help provide it, or check in with this new person about what they need. And that's a way to feel like you're doing something useful, I think.
And don't be shitty to interns.
Yeah.
Never be shitty to interns.
No.
You were an intern. People were shitty to you. You hated them.
Mm.
Don't be shitty to interns. And also, often they're going to end up in jobs, development jobs above you.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Happens all the time.
Yeah. You're going to be sitting across from them, begging them to make your movie about a talking dog.
No, I'm super nice to you. No, don't you remember that one time?
I feel like we've come back around to just like the everyday human interactions that sort of make up any job, you know, like there's always the creativity that we're talking about, like the brilliance, the moment where you do get to do your own thing, but then coming back to like the sort of quotidian, like, where do I write? Will people leave me alone when I write? And like, will I be, when I put it out there, how will I be judged? And I feel like increasingly part of the reason it's easy to have this conversation is that the reason this podcast can even exist is because I learned how to wipe my butt 20 years ago today. No. It's because like it is already growing and changing the way that people are represented. And it's no longer, this is not like the first of these conversations. I'd love to know, you know, more women and non-binary people are being at like the core of storytelling and their stories are being told. But are there, like you were talking about Little Women, what kind of stories are you reading now? Like who are you reading? Which writers do you love? And who would you recommend? This is my wrap-up question as we end on a positive note.
I have to look up the book I'm currently reading on my phone, if that's okay.
Of course. Okay. Monica, are you reading anyone at the moment that...
I'm rereading Sheila Hedy's Motherhood right now, which is one of the most like... impactful, I think, books for me that I've read in
really?
A really long time. Yeah.
Wow.
I was really interested in, first of all, it led to me going to a doctor and getting diagnosed with PMDD, which is basically like nuclear grade PMS.
Mm.
It dealt with the pressures, I guess.
Yeah.
The feeling of pressure. And I'm not necessarily feeling pressure to have a child, which is a central concern of the book, but pressure to bow to any kind of conventional life, and whether it's possible to be a creative person and want to engage with some of those more conventional things like getting married or having a child or, you know, owning a home, But whatever those convention, you know, just the pros and cons of conventionality, I guess.
Yeah.
And yeah, I found it very interesting to see someone feeling conflicted but also kind of ambivalent about these things that are supposed to be these really, to me, the character's main thing was that she kind of didn't feel one way or the other about this thing you're supposed to really know yes or no. So to see female ambivalence in that way,
I appreciated her ambivalence quite a bit. I think I like that quite a bit because I feel that way. I am currently reading Girl, Woman, Other Bernadine
Evaristo.
Yes.
Yeah.
So good.
Had to share the booker with Margaret Atwood.
Right.
I've said that in such a leading way. She had to share with fantastic author. No. I mean, I don't know. I mean, obviously.
Did Margaret Atwood need another award?
Listen, I've got a Canadian passport. I love Margaret Atwood. Okay. I'll say it. But yeah, I do. It did feel like it was, you know, she's this amazing Black British writer, and then the idea that to get to the Booker shortlist and then to win, but then still to have to share it with another woman and a white woman, that is,
I just,
is what it is.
It's such a, and I'm still reading it. I think it's so beautiful, so sharply observed. I fell in love with it, and every single character I'm in love with, and I'm in love with how it's a series of short stories, but all of the, every short stories are connected, characters are connected, will show up in other short stories.
Oh, it's a Love Actually.
It's a Love Actually. Slightly different. I just saw that for the first time. It's great. It's a good movie. It's got so many problems, but for the first time seeing it, I was like, wow, that actually hangs together quite well.
Every time I see it, I can't believe how early they bring up 9/11.
What a crazy thing. I texted that to Camille almost immediately. I was like, what? Why is 9/11 in the opening thing?
I know.
Felt really current at the time.
At the time, that was all we were talking
about. Front of mind. They added it. They were like, we got to address 9/11. It's a
Christmas film. Got to get it in. I love the idea that you came to London for a certain period of time and like you're heading off soon and you're like, got to watch Love Actually before I go.
It's a really good example of an ensemble movie. Ensemble movies are very tough to do. I think does it quite well.
Yes. Though I did see this is not my hot take, someone else's hot take that I'm repurposing, that three of the relationships are about like a senior male having a relationship with a young woman.
There's some real fucked up shit in that movie. No one is denying that. Also, the really fat woman in it, of course.
Oh, Marcy.
Martine McCutcheon.
I kept being like, are they fucking with me? Like, what? Yeah.
But also, I kept waiting for the big ass, which was not that big, to save the day in some way. Like,
I know.
Like, surely they can't keep talking about this so much.
It doesn't matter.
It's like Chekhov's big ass. Like, they have to use it at some point in the thing, and they just don't.
But also, as like, you know, the British cultural expert in the room, I should say that, like, it's not even like Martine McCutcheon was known as being like a larger lady in the press. That was not like, it wasn't like famous larger lady Martine McCutcheon. She was like, you know, a well-respected piece of hot totty, as we say in this country. And the idea that they, I felt really like, I'm going to use this word in the bad way, gaslit by that. Because I was like, no. We all find that lady attractive.
Big ass Hugh Grant.
But it also made me feel like maybe in the script, it felt like a casting thing, perhaps. Like in the script, maybe she was written to be a thicker milkshake. And then perhaps like when they came to casting, they're like, well, we're certainly not going
to
do that.
But also to me, it was like missing the real truth of it, which was like, it's the British class system is what we're talking about here, which was like,
that's interesting.
Like, that's really what it is. And then it's like, but her bum, am I right?
Yeah.
It is bonkers.
I have to say that like, it's these conversations that I so often have with my friends that where you just think, how are we still having these conversations? And then, but it's always in the, it's like, it's in the action, right? It's like in the scripts that get made. It's in the TV shows that actually come through. And thank you so much, both of you, for fighting the good fight. No, that's too sincere an ending for me. I've now...
Yeah, fuck... Do yeah, something sorry. Else.
Okay. Fuck you both.
Yeah!
No, I love this so much. You're both so smart, and I do... Oh, I have one thing. Do follow Bernadine Evaristo on Instagram.
Oh,
she's very good. This is what I do now. People are like, I've read this wonderful book, and I'm like, can I suggest a meme account on Instagram? I think my book is The Topeka School, not written by a woman, Ben Lerner, but it's kind of based on his real upbringing about his woman as an academic, his woman, an academic who in real life wrote this psychology book that was really big. She was on Oprah, and people used to call her, and but it was in the day of the landline, so it was like trolls, but they didn't have the internet, so they'd call the house.
That's so funny.
Because she didn't want to be unlisted. She thought it was like a mark of courage, but also just like every day will continue to stay in the book. And so that's the phone book for listeners under the age of whatever. But she would get these calls, and she had this tip and this trick, which
it's
was
cool
she would
that
say
they've found ways to do this.
Oh, this is not forever. New, is what I'm trying to say. Like, a woman having an
trolling
opinion.
Trolling him has always existed. Yeah,
in different forms. And I'm sure if we translate some of the ancient runes, it will be like, shut up.
Big ass.
Look at that ass. She had a thing where these callers would call, and she would say, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. The line's not very good. So she could perfectly hear them. They were saying things like, I bet your husband hates you or whatever. How does your husband feel? But she would be like, oh, I'm so sorry. The line's not very good. Would you say that again? And then the guy would have to be like, how does your husband feel? And like, just the act of just saying it again, of being called to repeat, to have any sort of like, say it louder, really like diffuse a lot of the tension, but also just to read about the idea that like we always feel like this stuff is really new, but of course it's been going on forever. And I think that would be the positive way in which we end this thing.
And then on a downbeat.
Yeah. Or basically like, don't take it personal. It's not you. It's society.
You can do it in a writing room too. If someone does has a misogynist joke or pitch, you can be like, what's funny about it?
Oh, that's such a great thing to do. Explain to me why that's funny.
Why is that funny?
Okay, so this is the point of the thing. Like, we write to understand, but we live to ask people, but why did you just say that? thank you so much, Monica and Emily.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And see you later. Goodbye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you're still listening to the little credits, wow, that's so nice. And you're exactly my kind of person. I'm a completist. What can I say? If you listened before, you'll know that the executive producer was Zachary Annette. Emma Caution essentially did all the work. She recorded, she mixed. I edited, which may be obvious at points. I must give credit to the Artisans via Jamendo Publishing for the very catchy tune all the way through. And thank you all so much for listening. Goodbye. Love you. Mean it.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.